It is time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage for Robinhood Radio and exclusive to Robinhood Radio. David is a multimedia and international journalist with his own online column at themediabeat.us. And as a special correspondent since 2012, he has contributed TV reports to the PBS network, mostly on ethical issues. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk reporting in from the media capital of the world, New York City, with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning September 29th, 2023. Longtime listeners to the Media Beat will, of course, know that I have, until now, always broadcast alongside the inimitable Marshall Miles. But, of course, Marshall has now left us, dying as he did in June this year. I feel very alone without him. But I will press on. There is, as ever, much media coverage to critique and reflect upon. That phrase, media capital of the world, was a kind of lightly ironic joke between Marshall and me. I'm kind of stereotypically based in New York as a media man, but I need to stress that it's good for me and for any journalist, I'd say, to spend time outside of this so-called capital. My summer was spent in Maine, a state that self-described in its advertising and on its vehicle license plates even, as vacation land, all one word. But there is a dark side to Maine, a current localized development that has broad national significance. There is stirring in the undergrowth, if I can put it that way, among neo-Nazis in Maine, attracting fellow neo-Nazis from elsewhere to the otherwise inoffensive small town of Springfield, Maine. Local media have been reporting efforts by a group known as Blood Tribe, led by a former Marine called Christopher Polhouse, to convert a 10-acre parcel of land that was purchased in his name into a paramilitary encampment and training ground. As we turn the corner into October and the fall session of Maine's legislature is set to begin, State Senator Joe Baldacci of Bangor is proposing new tightened state laws to curtail paramilitary training and demonstrations that are aimed at intimidating or threatening particular communities with violence. Members of the so-called Blood Tribe have been reported again by some alert Maine media, that's local newspapers, notably the Bangor Daily News, plus the redoubtable Maine Public Radio, to have been parading with swastika flags and banners insulting LGBTQ people. Among the banners was the slogan, "There will be blood." To my ears, legally non-expert though they are, that sounds pretty threatening and violent. Governor Janet Mills told the Maine Calling Show from Maine Public that she is, quote, deeply concerned by the developments in Springfield and that she would carefully review with her attorney general any proposed legislative changes, like the state senator's. His proposals, that is Senator Baldacci's, include a specific ban on training in the use of firearms and or explosives that could result in civil disorder. To quote the governor more fully, she warned the Nazis, "My administration will not hesitate to act the moment that anything they might do crosses the line from constitutionally protected speech to something else, some activity that might pose an immediate threat to the safety of Maine people." For his part, Mr. Polhouse, whose nickname among his Nazi followers is Hammer, has been defiant, telling reporters that no new laws would stop him and his tribe, or would limit their plans. He said on the ABC local affiliate, WVII-TV, that, quote, "See what I'm saying? None of this stuff affects me." On his feed on the Telegraph social platform, and there he's speaking, we can assume, largely to his own supporters, he wrote, "I am proud of my boys working till dusk at the camp, and we are seeing results." As I mentioned, I learned about this disturbing case thanks to some vigilant local media, but that may well be an exception to general trends. Maine is also suffering, like much of the country, from the slow or not so slow death of local journalism. According to some serious tallying done by Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, 2,500 local newspapers, a quarter of our country's total, have disappeared in the past two decades. And there's a growing amount of research, like for instance that done by Syracuse University's Institute for Democracy, Journalism and Citizenship, that shows just what can happen to the political climate when a local newspaper vanishes, or it is dramatically gutted by a corporate management, as they often are when a big company takeover or so-called merger happens. The result is what the Medill researchers, along with many of us in the business, have come to call our news deserts. And these deserts are growing unceasingly. Such drying up of a local audience's access to news about their own area will often, surprisingly quickly, be followed by lower voter turnout, increased polarization, and a general erosion of people's civic engagement. It makes it easier for disinformation to spread and for conspiracy theories to be fostered and deepened. Along with this, inevitably, you might think, there's greater scope for extremists, like Maine's Nazis, and other states' Nazis as well, of course, to gain greater traction. What is overarchingly true, although we may not like to admit it, is that far-right extremism is endemic in this country. And as I make this broadcast from New York, we shouldn't forget that despite this being the media capital of the world, and the media industry has helped to colour this city as a progressive place over many decades, New York nevertheless once saw Nazis taking over Madison Square Garden, and that's within living memory. It happened on the very eve of World War II in 1939. I'd commend to you a powerful short film about it by the young Oscar-winning documentary maker Marshall Curry called A Night in the Garden. He put together striking footage of the rally that was held in our world-famous arena by the German-American Bund, or Bond, which was our country's leading pro-Hitler organization. It was arranged ostensibly to celebrate George Washington's birthday and something that they called on their posters Americanism. A particular fascistic form of Americanism it was, without doubt. There were swastikas everywhere, Sieg Heil salutes, the lot. It's chilling stuff, and it can be found streaming at Prime Video if you'd like to take a look. A Night in the Garden. I recommend it as salutary viewing. And I recall that much of the same footage was used by Ken Burns in his PBS documentary series last year, The United States and the Holocaust. I will also report that this time of year in New York, the United Nations, with its headquarters along the East River, turns much of Manhattan into a parking lot. With traffic clogging the city streets as motorcades scream their way back to and from the annual United Nations General Assembly, which this year has also involved an added summit devoted to the climate change crisis. With so many overseas officials and dignitaries arriving, you might think it's the capital of the world, not merely the media capital. One prominent report emerging during this week from the UN's Human Rights Division has been a thoroughgoing survey of Russia's conduct of its full-scale invasion into Ukraine, a war that's now reached 19 months in duration. A special inquiry commission was set up by the UN Human Rights Council to investigate the war, and it has now damningly accused Russian forces of war crimes, namely attacks on civilians, torture of captured individuals, and sexual and gender-based violence, including rape. The accusations are being interpreted in the international media as supportive, though not in so many words exactly, of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and the message he delivered at the UN as he spoke angrily about Russian genocide. It may be hard to discern that Human Rights Council news among all the deluge of news from the UN during this period of summitry and, of course, among the scattershot news from Ukraine's actual war fronts, including its slow, slugging counter-offensive against the Russians. But the UN Commission report is an extraordinary instance of global condemnation for Vladimir Putin's Russia. I must hasten to add something, though, as someone who spent a dozen years or more reporting on the UN here at headquarters and on many of its missions around the world. What I'd add is a word of caution in case anyone might be expecting some direct action coming as a result of this tough-talking UN report. Russia, of course, sits as a permanent member on the UN Security Council, and as such it wields the power of veto. Russia is not, incidentally, any longer a member of the Human Rights Council, being suspended after invading its neighbour. But the Security Council is where power at the UN ultimately resides, and my message as a grizzled UN observer is don't hold your breath for any concerted global measures now being taken against the Kremlin. Switching to domestic American concerns again, the big news from the West Coast is that the Hollywood writers' strike is effectively settled, subject only to a membership-wide vote that seems well-nigh certain to ratify the new deal. But the Screen Actors are still on strike. The auto industry is still perhaps increasingly at a high pitch of confrontation, though the Ford company seems to have stepped away from its fellow companies in being more prepared to discuss a new pay and conditions offer to the Auto Workers Union. Irresistible photo ops came along this week with President Joe Biden visiting the car plant picket lines in support of the strikers, wearing the apparently requisite baseball cap, and his leading rival among Republican contenders, Donald Trump. In an interesting switch, Trump was not wearing his baseball cap with his Make America Great Again logo on it, but he too was of course trying to gain auto workers' support. This was the very next day after the president's visit, and here's the really telling difference. Trump was at a non-unionized manufacturing plant. These back-to-back media set pieces are maybe harbingers for the forthcoming presidential contest as a whole. The all-consuming effort to swing support on bread-and-butter issues at a time when the economy is, by all conventional measures, or at least numerical metrics, doing rather well, while at the same time a majority of Americans have a dismal view of the economy, not least because the real-life cost of living appears to them worse, not better, than it was in previous times. And hovering over it all are the poll results in just about every survey that the media have commissioned or consulted, saying that both likely candidates for the top office are simply too old for it. I will cite my grizzled status once again and bow out of that age appropriateness debate. I will say that another matter is being subjected to intensive polling by the media too, on the subject of our imminently looming government shutdown, which, as I speak, is likely to be forced on the nation by that handful of obdurately anti-government Republican House representatives, popular sentiment is making itself very clear. It is a highly unpopular move, shutting down the government. 2 out of 3 Americans say so. Makes you wonder what media the little right-wing band are reading, or maybe what they're smoking, that makes them believe their stubborn stand is good politics for them. I'm David Tereshchuk, and this has been this week's The Media Beat. If you have been, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.